Unfortunately, you guys missed the best part of the interview because during the commercial break, Jim and I were talking about mine and his inguinal hernia surgery. Jim Burling is the director. He used to be the director of litigation, then vice president of litigation, now vice president of legal affairs. Jim had been before an attorney, he was an exploration geologist in the 1970s in the Southwest U.S. But after dealing with what he calls an irrational government full of bureaucrats and environmental policies untethered from reality, to give you an idea of how Jim feels, he decided the world needs more lawyers fighting for rationality and property rights, and now he's Pacific Legal Foundation Vice President for Legal Affairs. Welcome back to Radio Real Estate, Jim Burling.
Hey, nice to be back with you, Mark.
Yeah, you were on last time, and we talked about your book, which we'll circle back to, which has the longest title in the history of books, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Crisis, Why So Much of America is Now Unlivable. And but you are involved and aware of a case. By the way, I think last time I made the joke, you should be vice president for illegal affairs, not legal affairs. Because if things are legal, then you're not involved.
Right. And the case you're about to ask me about is a true case of illegal behavior by a local government.
Well, I've talked about eminent domain before, but this is the first time I read about eminent domain being used almost behind the back. A Rhode Island town seizes family's land in an eminent domain scandal, and they took it secretly from a 31-acre
property.
They
took it double secretly.
Yeah? What's that about?
So, I mean, to back up just a little bit, the Salvador family owns about 31 acres of property in a Rhode Island suburb called Johnson. It's just outside of Providence, Rhode Island. And they wanted to build a apartment complex on the property. State law encouraged it because state law recognizes that we need, in Rhode Island as in everywhere else, more affordable housing. And these were apartments that were going to be targeted to people earning about 80% of the median income. In other words, your typical school teacher, post office worker, carpenter, that sort of person. And the apartments would be rented to them. Well, the town didn't like that idea. Now, in the town of Johnson, only 7% of the housing is affordable, but the town didn't like that at all. And the mayor said that, look, if you insist on moving forward with the currently proposed project, I will use all the power of the government I have to stop it. I'm going to grind this project to a halt, and I have zero care about who I may offend in the process. And then he finally continued, be prepared to fight a town with 30,000 people. That was the mayor of the town of Johnson threatening the owners of the property that if they moved ahead with a state-authorized project to build apartments, that this is what he was going to do. So on January 27th of this year, the mayor said he was going to seize the property by eminent domain because they were going to use it for a new municipal complex. Now, up until this time, there's zero evidence that the town had ever considered building a new municipal complex. They had a perfectly good one in the center of town, but they happened to figure out that they wanted to build it on this 31 acres on the outskirts of town. Anything to stop the project. So we sued. A couple months later, on March 10th, we sued and we said, look, this is a pretextual use of eminent domain. There wasn't a real public use here. The only thing the town was doing was to condemn this property, which is to stop the apartments. And we had a pretty good case. But 2 days later, after we sued, the town transferred the land in secret. And I literally mean that, in secret. Normally, when a government entity condemns property through eminent domain, they have to file a notice, they go to court, they put a deposit down of what the property is worth, and the property owners are notified in advance that this is going to happen. This is not something that's done in secret. But the city did this in secret on March 12th. They took possession of the property by going to the recording office and basically having the recorder change the deed so the town owned it. And they did this without providing compensation, without notice. And they didn't tell the owners about it until 2 days later, until it was all complete, March 14th. And we think that's, we consider that to be municipal thuggery. And the town mayor tweeted 2 days later that as of 10:40 a.m. this morning, through a petition to the Superior Court, the town of Johnson's officially acquired ownership of the property, and we own it. And furthermore, it sent a via a tweet and a letter, it told the owners that if you go onto the property to do anything but remove your vehicles from it, we're going to cite you for trespass and arrest you for trespassing onto the property that you owned until 2 days ago, and now it is our property. I mean, this is astonishing. I mean, we hear a lot of abuses of eminent domain, but to come in and be so blatant about not allowing affordable housing because the, and I quote again, the wrong element might move into the housing, it's astonishing, even for Rhode Island.
Okay, let me stop you for a moment. My guest is Jim Burling, Vice President for Legal Affairs with the Pacific Legal Foundation. So to get this correct in order, the mayor decided and told them that that's what he was going to establish eminent domain, take the land. Then you filed a lawsuit, and then, without notice or without compensation, he literally went down and recorded and took the land. So my first question is, has that ever happened before where a government entity uses eminent domain with no notice, no compensation, and just does it secretly? Is this a first?
Well, for us, I mean, we talked to some other eminent domain attorneys we know that are practiced around the country, and nobody has told us that they've ever experienced anything like this before. I mean, this is just astonishing to have done this in secret when there is a process for city to get it. And it's a process that should be followed. I mean, that's the whole point of having processes to protect the rights of all parties.
Well, I don't know if the mayor consulted with an attorney, but it doesn't sound like he did. And when you said the mayor decided, I remember when I first started this program and I made a big deal about having the mayor in town. But for example, in city of Santa Barbara, our mayor would like to reopen State Street. It's been closed since the pandemic, and it's a big controversy. And you know, who knows what the majority of people want? But the mayor has a city council, and there might be one or two who agree with him, but the majority don't. So what's the story with this town of, what is it, Johnsonville? Johnson?
Johnson, city of Johnson. So how does
the mayor have that kind of power? Did the whole city council agree with him?
Well, the city council seemed to be going along with the idea that they were going to seize it by eminent domain. Okay, this is what they did in January 27th. They kind of agreed to the sham eminent domain, but they actually didn't do it yet. And that didn't do it pursuant to the proper procedures. They did it in the secret way 2 days after we filed in federal court. And so I think what was going on in their mind, especially in the mayor's mind, that they wanted to make sure that the federal court, that they would have the property before the federal court could do anything about it.
With your lawsuit, you mean?
Yeah. Before the court could hold, the federal court could hold a hearing on our lawsuit and do anything, the mayor thought it was a good idea just to grab the property, and that part he did on his own.
He just buried himself. There's no way that he can prevail on that alone. Now, if he hadn't prevailed, if he hadn't chosen that path, then you would just be fighting. Now, am I correct that the mayor wanted them, he wasn't against building housing, he just wanted them to build single-family homes. Is that correct?
So he said, yeah, you could have single-family homes that rich people live in. Look, the typical cost of a single-family home in the area is over $600,000. You know, that's kind of standard by California standards, but it's unaffordable for a lot of people. State law allows the sort of apartment buildings. I mean, state law was a state law in Rhode Island was adopted in 2024. Encouraging this type of development for apartments.
Let's unwind this a little bit. Let's say he didn't do this eminent domain, secret eminent domain, and you were going along fighting for the owner's right to build the apartments versus being forced to build single family home. I wonder if the town might have had a better chance of prevailing, because they weren't saying you can't build housing, they just want a specific type of housing, even though you mentioned the state is encouraging more affordable housing, it's probably not as draconian as California, taking away local control, offering builders remedies, and really, like, for example, within 3/4 mile of my house, there's like several areas where they're going to be putting all this dense apartments. And down at La Cumbre Plaza, they want to put over 1,100 apartments. It's going to be insanely high density, and I don't know how it's going to survive with the traffic alone. So I'm just wondering what you thought, theoretically.
Those are all concerns that you can have when you build something in an area, and the town is making noises about that, but it doesn't seem to be borne out by the facts. But that's the sort of thing that would have been unwound in the normal process of court hearings, whether or not the town had legitimate reasons for pursuing a condemnation action against this. But what the town ended up, and you were kind of getting at this, by going about it in secret, while there's a federal court action that had been filed, the federal district court judge was not happy because she thought that what the town was doing was basically trying to freeze things in place so the federal jurisdiction would be rendered nugatory. Mm-hmm. And so a couple days after the town took the property, well, 5 days after, we asked for a temporary restraining order, and the court granted it. And the court made it pretty clear that the town was enjoined from taking any action on the property, interfering the family from entering, using it, the property, preventing the city from entering, using it, conveying it, or encumbering it, trespassing on it. And furthermore, the court said that you have to undo the thing that you did on March 12th. You have to give the property back to the owners of the property, and then we can proceed apace with a normal process of trying to figure out the normal permitting process.
Okay, so what do you think? Do you think the town will reverse itself, give it back, and then you'll have the other fight? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what we hope will happen. That we'll have the normal development fight going on that you normally have, and it's not going to be all wound up with this eminent domain abuse that we're seeing right now. I would hope the town would get that message. The mayor seems to be unrepentant. The mayor said after we asked for the injunction, he said that we remain committed to advocating for the best interests of the current residents of Johnson. And then he continued, I have no intention of succumbing to these developers or their elitist California-based legal organization. That would be me.
You're making me laugh. My guess is the vice president of legal affairs for the Pacific Legal Foundation, where they select cases and they don't charge. They run on donations. And I first heard about you guys back in the late 90s when I started this program from Marilyn Senegals, who lived in Summerlin. And man, she donated to you. And when she passed away, she left you guys a nice chunk of change. She really believed in you, and she got me onto you, and that's how I've been doing interviews with you guys over the years. So, Jim Burling, Vice President of Legal Affairs. So, I want to have time to talk a little bit about your book. So, to wrap this up, time-wise, what's the next month or two look like?
So, we got the temporary restraining order converted to a preliminary injunction, and now we're probably going to the town may file a motion to dismiss the case, and then we will oppose that. Eventually, we're going to have discovery to find out all the motivations of the town, perhaps some discovery on the impacts of the project and whether the project conforms to state law, that kind of thing. And eventually, the court is going to issue an order, and we believe the order will be that the town cannot take this property under eminent domain because it's just not doing it the right way, and it doesn't have any real justification. It's a sham taking. It's against state law.
And how much time? How much time in a best case scenario might you get a decision on that phase?
A few months, the best case, a year or so, worst case.
Oh my God! And then the battle then goes back to: can the city force him to build single family over the apartments? Then there's a next.
Right. That'll be another battle, and another one that I think under state law.
Okay.
The town doesn't have many legs to stand on, but we'll see.
I know I shouldn't say this on the air, because I believe in private property rights. And I believe, of course, in building affordable housing to a certain degree. Sometimes it's where do you build it? Sometimes they end up making decisions to put it like in the heart of downtown where nobody can really afford to live and they'd like to live there. And so a lot of people would like to see them move affordable housing a little bit more on the outskirts. But I hate to say this, but I should see if the county of Santa Barbara can establish eminent domain on some of these projects near my house so I can avoid the apartments. But of course, I'm joking, partially. Okay.
We'll see you in court.
Exactly. But interestingly, one of the parcels is owned by the school district, so it's kind of a government agency. I don't know if that would make a difference.
As far as the ability of one government agency to condemn another, it becomes tricky.
But not necessarily condemn, but to force them to build single family homes or to, you know, scale back on the project, because technically the state has denuded local authorities to impose any restrictions.
Yeah, so partly it's what the school district wants to do and what pressure they want to succumb to. So
right.
You know, that's right. A level of politics that I'm not intimately familiar with.
There you go. Okay, so Jim, you wrote this book. Did you write it last? I think you were on in August of 2024.
When
did
it got published in August, right.
Okay, so you've been a property rights attorney for 40 years, and you wrote this book, The Hidden Story of America's Crisis. We have nowhere to live. I mean, it's kind of funny. You wrote this book, and here we are. You're defending a case where you want to create places for people to live that's affordable. Why so much of America is unlivable? We just have a few minutes left, but tell me how the sale of the book is going, and what your intent of writing that book. What the book is telling us.
So the sales of the book are going pretty well for a book dealing with real estate issues. I think it's going very well. It's been up in the ranks in Amazon books on real estate law and the general topic of housing and the housing crisis we have right now. And my basic underlying thesis is that we have gotten ourselves into this mess of a lack of affordable housing because we have so many rules and restrictions, whether it's zoning laws, environmental laws, and the abuse of eminent domain to prevent us from building the housing that we need. I mean, we have a severe supply and demand problem. And what I'm saying is a lot of the zoning laws we have are antiquated. They encourage only large lot single family homes throughout vast areas of cities, or there's virtually no areas where you can build apartments. Now, the reaction that you're talking about a few minutes ago, that the California legislature, essentially, as you put it, ramming down the throats of local governments, more affordable housing, that is a response. Perhaps it's a nuclear level response to only a conventional war problem. But it's a response to the recalcitrance of so many local communities to allow any kind of affordable housing in their communities, whether it's duplexes or triplexes or accessory dwelling units. We time and time again, projects that are modest in scale are just scuttled because of the intense problems of trying to get the permitting to do it. And that is a significant problem that continues. If you look at today's Los Angeles Times, I think it was, there's a long article, maybe it was Washington Post, I read too much, about how permitting in Los Angeles is just an impossible thing to build single family homes or triplexes or duplexes. So my point in my book is that the housing crisis is the fault of all of us by not allowing enough housing to be built. And in order to have more affordable housing, in order to alleviate the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis that we have, we really need to open up and allow people who own property to use that property for housing if they so wish.
And it took a long time to get to today. And I'm looking on a little blurb from your book. It says, with stories from the Civil War to today.
Rent control started in the Civil War. And then at the turn of the century, the forces in downtown Chicago waterfront is where you had the first control of rents of properties, started out with commercial rents. And one of the dissenting justices at the Supreme Court said, well, what's next if you can have commercial rent control? What's next? Or you can have residential rent control? And of course, that's unconstitutional. Well, as we know, rent control is well established nowadays, and it is a terrible disincentive for building new homes in communities with rent control, because developers simply can't make a pencil out if they're going to be threatened with rent control.
I hear you. On its face, it sounds like a good idea to create affordable housing in certain areas, certain things. But as they always say, the law of unintended consequences. My guest has been James Burling. I keep calling you Jim. What do you go by?
I go by both. You can call me Jim. My friends call me Jim, so call me Jim.
Well, thank you. I consider you a friend. I appreciate your time. Jim Burling, Vice President, Legal Affairs at the Pacific Legal Foundation. If you support what they're doing, go to their website and look. Consider donating. Pacific Legal Foundation. And the book he wrote is Nowhere to Live. Check it out if you like. Jim, next time we'll discuss our inguinal hernia surgery, okay?
With great pain,
And I'm 4 weeks in. I read online I should wait for 6 weeks before I really do stuff, but it could take 3 months before I'm out hauling bricks in my wheelbarrow.
Yeah, you're going to want to wait. You don't want to go through what you just went through again, do you?
Sound advice. Jim Burling, Pacific Legal Foundation, thanks a million.
All right. Great talking with you.
You too, Jim. Bye-bye. Okay. And we've got a couple of stories for you. I want to recap the poem that was aired last week. We've got a sale of the leased land over that I always exclude, but I thought you'd want to hear this. Had a discussion with a lender about fudging loan applications. That's been in the news lately. So we got more to come. Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate. Stay tuned. You'll be right back.